Well, Mark chapter 10 could not have been more appropriate as a passage for this morning, because the disciples are having their equivalent of a squabble about who'll be party leader. That's what's going on here. James and John have nominated themselves. Have a look, verse 37. Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. Now, what do you think they were planning on sitting on? A couple of stools, perhaps? A cushion? The floor? No, no, no. They wanted thrones. As you probably know, they came from a well-to-do middle-class family. Their father owned a fishing business. It may well be that they found in following Jesus, they rather missed having servants around. So they were perhaps willing to leave their home family fishing business as long as they were compensated by a different throne in the end. And do you remember in Matthew's gospel who asked for thrones? Their mother. Have you got a mother like that, pushing her boys forward? A real middle-class mother? And then, of course, the others, having heard this push for Home Secretary and Chancellor of the Exchequer from James and John, can you have a look down verse 41, were indignant because they thought, well, those guys have cornered the votes. I may have missed the second ballot. So they pushed their own names forwards. And Jesus then rounds on both groups. And in three verses that are astonishing and revolutionary, he speaks of what it means to follow him. Have a look as you would at verse 42. Can we see as we look down? Jesus called them together. Can you imagine the look on his face? You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. And then these four lines, not so with you. John Stott said, those four words are to be underlined in red in every Christian's Bible. Not so with you. Whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant. So do you want to be great? Do you want to head for parliament? Go as a servant. Whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. Now, in Jesus' day, the standard of greatness was power, ladies and gentlemen. The test was, how many people does a man control? How great an army of servants obey his every command? How many can he impose his will upon? So the Emperor Galba was to sum up the ancient idea of greatness and kingship when he said on becoming emperor, now that I'm emperor, I can do what I like and do it to anyone. And here Jesus introduces a revolutionary new style of leadership that's to be exercised by example, not by coercion. Here there is to be no trampling. In verse 43, Jesus redefines what it means to be great. Ladies and gentlemen, it's by serving. That's countercultural. In verse 44, he redefines what it means to be first. It's to be the slave of all. And the word slave here is yakinos, which means one whose activities are not directed by their own interests, but by the interests of another. So leaders, Christian leaders, are not to be on a power trip. They're called to serve in the pattern of Jesus. In his kingdom, the standard is service. Greatness consisted not in reducing other people to one service, but in reducing oneself to their service. So the authentic symbol of Christian leadership is not the purple robe of the emperor. No, it's the towel of Jesus as half naked. The night before he dies, he washes his disciples' feet. And if you arrive at a church, and I don't care what country you're from, I don't care what the cultural norms in your country are in terms of leadership, but if you arrive at a church where the leaders are on an ego trip, where there's a power trip, where there's status, where they're looking for that, leave. Don't stay. Whatever the cultural norm is, you get out. Because this is a non-negotiable of Christian leadership. Are they serving? And Jesus illustrates this principle of servant leadership by speaking of himself. He says, look at me. He says, worldly leadership is like a pyramid with the leaders at the top and bossing everyone beneath them. But in my kingdom, the leaders are the servants underneath holding everyone up. Follow my lead. And if you want to believe and follow Jesus, then you've got to grasp, can we see, verse 45. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So as we look at God the Son and believing in him, we'll look in this verse at three things: his sovereignty, his sacrifice, and his servant spirit. So first of all, his sovereignty. Who is he? And can you see as you look down, verse 45, he's the Son of Man. Now, this title used by Jesus is a title with a history. The Old Testament uses it for an ultimately significant figure in Daniel 7. Daniel has a vision of the heart of the universe. It's the heavenly court sat in judgment. We're right at the center of the universe. The curtain has been pulled back on the heavenly court. And in Daniel 7, verses 13 and 14, we see who Jesus is and where he is now. We see his identity and his location. Let's have a look at the verse. In my vision, at night, I looked, says Daniel, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Now, can you see what kind of figure this Son of Man is? To speak of him as a figure of authority is an understatement. Verse 14, to him was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. He has power over everyone, all languages, all people from all countries worship him. So here is one of awesome authority with total rule, and it will go on forever. He's like a son of man, so he's like a human being. He's not like the beasts in Daniel 7. No, he doesn't rule like a beast destructively and selfishly, which is so much of what we see today. He's all that a human being is meant to be, and yet he's more than a man. He's God's perfect king, God's supreme king, God's eternal king. Verse 13, can we see, coming with the clouds of heaven, in scripture, only God himself comes with clouds. So he's distinct, and he approaches the Ancient of Days, the throne of God himself. Why is God called the Ancient of Days? Because he's always been there. Because he's there from eternity to eternity. And this Son of Man is given, can we see verse 14? Authority, glory, sovereign power over all people, all nations, everywhere, forever. It will not pass away, it will not be destroyed. And this, ladies and gentlemen, this is how Jesus referred to himself again and again and again. This is his identity. And so often our view of Jesus is so, so pathetically small. Now, I don't know if you ever thought about why democracy is a good way to rule a country. So why is democracy a good way to rule a country? Well, it's good because, as we're finding in parts of the world stage, if you put one person in control, they often turn out to be a beast, to rule badly. So democracy is good simply because it limits human power. It stops one person being in control on their own. And yet, of course, democracy has its flaws because it's so hard to get anything done because you've such limits on your power. Its benefits that it limits power is often its downfall. You don't have the power to do what needs to be done. No, what we need in a perfect world is a perfect ruler. One person to be in charge with the power to get things done, but doing everything right, ruling rightly, justly, mercifully. That's what we see here. We see here Jesus, the perfect king. And living under God's perfect king will be perfect. But we might want to ask, well, I'm sure you're asking this right now. When is this going to happen? When will Jesus be crowned king and rule the world and make it all perfect? Because at present, in the political malaise, am I the only one who longs for this? Well, one answer is when Jesus returns, when he comes back. At that moment, the beasts, the world's evil, will be destroyed, and every knee will bow. Everyone will worship him, and everything will be as it should be. And yet there is a sense in which this has already happened. I've got to understand that in my doctrine, in my Christology. When Jesus rose from the dead and ascended into heaven, he, verse 13 of Daniel 7, approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. So when Jesus ascended into heaven, and please see the direction of verse 13 in Daniel 7 is upwards, he ascended and sat down at the right hand of God and was crowned king. So in Acts 7, a few weeks after the resurrection, Stephen is stoned to death by beastly rulers. Beastly rulers stone Stephen. And as he dies, do you remember what he says? What does he say? Look, I see heaven opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. Why is Jesus standing? Leslie Newbegin says, because he is greeting his first martyr. That's why he's standing. But he's ascended. He's already there. He's crowned king next to God. So there's a sense in which it has happened, and yet we're still waiting. It's happened, but we're still waiting. He's the king now, but we're waiting for him to come back when Daniel 7:14, everyone will acknowledge him as king. And many will do it with a shout of praise, and billions will do it with a shout of agony. But all will acknowledge him. At the moment, the world is not as he would want it to be. His rule is not fully implemented. And that will only happen when he returns. Oh, it's a bit like buying a house or a flat. And you say to me, Rico, chance would be a fine thing in London. And I know what you mean. But anyway, imagine you're buying a house or a flat. You're getting a property. Anyway, after the hassle of mortgages, surveys, the day arrives. The contracts are signed, the money's wired through, and the house is yours from that moment. You own it, you're in charge, it's your house, you've got it. Of course, you don't actually live there yet. But a few days later, maybe longer, you actually move in, and those who were there have now gone, and you start making the house your home, what you want it to be. You arrange the furniture, you paint the walls, you live in the house, you go to IKEA. So there is the moment of the house becoming yours, and there's the moment of you taking possession of your house and making it all you want it to be. Well, it's something like that with Jesus and this world. When he rises from the dead, ladies and gentlemen, that is the moment he's crowned king of the world. From that moment, it's his, he owns it, he's in charge. But then there is the moment when he moves in and takes possession and makes everything as he wants it to be. He's crowned king, it's happened, but as we know from our political situation, we're still waiting for him to move in. So once we see that it's happened, it will happen, then there's no doubt that God will establish his perfect king. There's no doubt it has already happened. He is already enthroned. He just has to come back and implement his rule. Now, in the creed that we read, that's what's going on. Shall I read it to you? As we look down line 4. On the third day, he rose again. He ascended into heaven. That's what Stephen saw. And is seated at the right hand of the Father. He'll come again to judge the living and the dead. And when we see who this sovereign Lord is, and we see the rule that he will conduct, it becomes absolutely staggering that when he came into this world, he came not to be served, but to serve. I mean, it's not a misprint. Why did the Son of Man come? It must be a misprint when you think who Jesus is. But we see he came to serve. And he became a servant, despite the fact he's God from God, light from light, true God from true God. He comes to serve. The poet Simon Jenkins sums it up. It's like your landlord becoming your lodger, like your managing director up before you for an interview, like Beethoven queuing for a ticket for his own concert, like a headmaster getting the cane, like a good architect living in a slum built by a rival. Like Picasso painting by numbers, God lived among us. It's an astonishing reversal. Instead of coming to be served, he'll serve. And it won't be any old service either. No, we move on to his sacrifice. Why did he come? Well, Jesus himself said that he came to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus uses the idea of a ransom price to describe his death. Now, this idea of ransom was very familiar to the Jew in Jesus' day. The Old Testament was full of the need to pay a price or a fine or damages in certain instances. And as we look at the Old Testament now, don't get the impression that a desire for passion, for justice, for fairness and rightness is a modern thing. It's embedded in the Bible, particularly in the legal texts, in places like Leviticus and Deuteronomy. There's this desire to make sure that fairness and justice is done. So here we have Exodus chapter 21, 29 and 30. If, however, the bull has had the habit of goring, in other words, it's thoroughly out of control, and the owner has been warned but has not kept it penned up, and it kills a man or woman, the bull is to be stoned and its owner also is to be put to death. That's severe. But the Bible is saying you are responsible for what you own. I mean, the modern application is your car. You've got to get it serviced, or your bicycle. If the brakes go and you hit someone, you're responsible. Well, the Bible takes very seriously my responsibility for all I own and all I do. However, the Bible realizes it would be very severe for the owner to be put to death for it. So it says, do we see as we look down? However, if payment is demanded, the word for payment there is ransom, the owner may redeem his life by payment, ransom, of whatever is demanded. So any Jew was saturated in the idea that people had to pay damages, pay fines, pay to redeem things. They'd understand the language of Mark 10:45. And this would also be obvious to the Greek who was listening to Jesus, and many did. Because for the Greeks, a ransom was a deliverance from freedom, the purchased at a price. Because in the Hellenistic world, the ransom was the price paid to release, for example, a prisoner of war. Now, when used in the New Testament, all these practical, legal, and financial ideas disappear. And the idea of ransom is spiritualized to refer to the death of the Lord Jesus Christ as the price that was paid for salvation. Think of the figure that he is, all authority and power, and yet he comes to pay this price. That's the phrase that's given here. He comes to give his life. Well, surely it causes us to ask, if the Son of Man has to die, the one who has authority, glory, and sovereign power, if he has to die to pay this ransom, then we have to ask, in what ways are we captive? We had a weekend last weekend. The men went away, 80 men, and there was a weekend on sin. Actually, I got back from it and I was using my mobile phone when I said I wouldn't. And my wife said, it doesn't sound as though your sin weekend's gone very well, Rico. But in what ways are we captive? And the first thing that Nick Tucker said to us is, don't forget, the first thing that happens with sin is the devil uses it to deceive. He deceives, he lies, he blinds. Are you blind here? Can you see the seriousness? If you can't, there's a terrible blindness. And to see what we're captive to, well, Mark 7, 21 to 23, earlier on in the gospel, Jesus makes it clear what the problem is. Let me read it to you. Mark 7, 21, 23. This is your problem. Open your blind eyes, please. Jesus went on. What comes out of a person is what defiles them. For it's from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly, all these evils come from inside and defile a person. Now, the context of Mark 7 is the religious authorities. And they've been saying, no, no, no. You can get right with God by how you wash and where you go and what you do. And Jesus says, You're looking past the problem of the heart. That won't solve the heart, the problem. You may honour me with your lips, but your hearts are far from me. So here's the question. What's really wrong with the world? Why can the world be such a miserable place? Why is there so much strife between nations, races, tribes, classes? Why do relationships tend to fray and fall apart? Why do we sometimes hurt the people we love most? Why don't we automatically do the right thing? Why is this great inclination to selfishness in so many of us, in all of us? Well, Jesus is saying, we're what's wrong. We're the problem. It's what comes from inside. The self-centeredness of the human heart, it's sin. And sinful behavior, ladies and gentlemen, please open your eyes to this, is like fire that has broken out in your living room. Let's say a cushion is on fire. You can't sit there and say, well, the whole house isn't burning, it's just a cushion. Yet so many do. So many do. If you don't do something immediately and decisively about the cushion, the whole house will be engulfed. Fire is never satisfied. It can't be allowed to smoulder. It can't be confined to a corner. It will overtake you eventually. And sin is the same way. It's why Jesus was so ruthless as he spoke of sin. He said, if it's your hand, cut it off. If it's your eye, pluck it out. If it's your foot, cut it off. But the problem here is, it's my heart. And I can't take out my heart. What am I to do? Well, I'm in desperate need of rescue. The fire will keep on burning. Sin never stays at the same place. And it always leads to separation from God, which results in suffering and isolation, first in this life, and then in the next, in hell. Literally in fire. And the Son of Man comes to the cross to give his life as a payment for your sin. It is that serious. Please don't be deceived. He comes to save us from hell through the cross for heaven. You must be so precious to him that he is prepared to leave heaven and to do this for you. Because it means I have to ask the personal question, have you been served in this way? Not the world, not your family, you. You see, it's not enough to say Jesus died for many. I need to say he died for me. The fire in my heart is so engulfing that it will take me to judgment and rightly to hell. And the only escape is the ransom Jesus paid in death and blood for me. You see, my sin is so serious that only the death of the Son of God will pay for it. I love the way that Psalm 49 sums this up. No one can redeem the life of another or give to God a ransom for them. The ransom for a life is costly. No payment is ever enough so that they should live on forever and not see decay. So the problem with Bill Gates and the problem with Warren Buffett is that they've not earned enough money. They're not rich enough to pay for their sin. In fact, they'll never be rich enough. There's only one thing that will pay for your sin, verse 15. But God will redeem me from the realm of death. He'll surely take me to himself, and to prove it, he raises his son from the dead. That is the historical root that I have. So as we see in the creed, on the third day he rose again. It's got historical close. But the proof there is that my ransom can be paid. Sin leads to death. The cross deals with my sin. The resurrection deals with my death. I've got a friend. She's a doctor. She was working in palliative care. She told an old man that he had terminal cancer. There was nothing could be done. He looked at her and he said, okay, I get it. How much do I pay? And she looked at him. There's nothing that can pay. You can't pay. Only Christ can pay. And so as we come to communion, what does it mean to follow him? Well, I mean, he's the Son of Man. with all authority, glory, sovereign power. And he comes not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. So what does it mean to follow him? Well, we want to come to communion as we see this, but it means that we're presented with a choice between self-seeking and self-sacrifice. Well, the choice is staggering. Can you see it? It's between the sons of Zebedee, James and John. We want you to do for us whatever we ask. And the Son of Man. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Can you see there's no harmonization? We have to choose between two value systems and two lifestyles. That's why you've got to leave the church of a Christian leader who's chosen the first one. There's no harmonization between these two philosophies. James and John may call Jesus teacher, but they've missed a key facet of his teaching. And actually, wonderfully, this is symbolized in All Souls. Can you see as you come to this building? You see, ahead of me, again, by the organ at the top there, is the fact that this is a crown appointment, the royal coat of arms. And that royal coat of arms with the roaring lion is associated with the power, status, wealth, and honor of central London. Many come here and they're self-seeking. But alongside it is the choice, the picture, eki homo. And there is Jesus, Mark 10:45, offering his life as a ransom. Behold the man going to die, sacrificing himself. It symbolizes the choice. So often when I come into this building, I look at those two and I think, here's the choice. Rico, what are you going to do today? What your heart wants, Mark 10:35. What Christ wants, Mark 10:45. And you see, when it came to James and John, where were their daydreams? They wanted adulation. They wanted success. They wanted power. They wanted status. They wanted significance. They wanted to be known and admired. And Jesus says, not so with you. Not so with you. Let's pray together. Well, God is sovereign. Jesus is my ransom. And now there's the call to serve. As we prepare for communion, a chance to confess our sin. When have I had the wrong model of greatness in my mind? When have I turned my back on the fact that greatness is in serving? When have I followed the way of James and John and not the way of Jesus? When have I been self-seeking and hardened my heart to God and others as I see the call to self-sacrifice but ignore it?